Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the fourth Teneo Insights call on the impact of COVID-19, something that continues to dominate all of our lives. I'm Craig Oliver, the principal of the Situations and Politics practice here at Teneo. Each week, we're bringing together our friends in the business world. Close to 200 of you have been joining these calls to listen to our senior team and other guests with their insights and who will then answer some of your questions. I just want to say, if you drag your cursor to the top right side of your screen, you should see a chat function. So please feel free to ask any questions as they occur to you, stating who you are, and I'll try and get them answered in the second half of the call. Now, before we get there, I have to do one thing, which I'm doing every week for legal reasons. If you are a journalist on the call, please leave. This isn't intended for publication in any way. So with that done, today we have an incredible group of guests. Adrian Gore is the CEO of the major international business Discovery. In the UK, we know his work through Vitality and Stanley the Sausage Dog, but his partners with some of the biggest insurers around the world, including Ping An in China, Sumitomo in Japan, Generali in Europe, John Hancock in America. He's also one of the most thoughtful and nicest people I know, so he's going to be giving his insights into business and how it's affected him. Amber Rudd, you all know, is a senior advisor at Teneo and a former Home Secretary, and she's going to talk about the crisis at the top of the UK government at the moment with Boris in an intensive care unit. Dr. Jerry Cower is also a Teneo senior advisor, and he's also former Assistant Secretary for Public Health Emergencies at the US Department of Health and Human Services. That's the equivalent of our Department of Health in the UK. And he's going to be talking about the latest efforts to get on top of COVID-19. And of course, the man who's been a staple of all these calls, Wolf Pickerley, one of the co-presidents of our political risk advisory, is going to talk to us too. We'll open it up to questions that are being submitted via the chat function after they've all spoken. But I'm going to begin with you, Amber. Boris Johnson's in an intensive care unit. That's an extraordinary situation for the Prime Minister or head of government to be in. Can you tell us about what you think is currently going on in government about that? Update us on the situation. And do you think the government's set up to withstand that?
Thank you very much, Craig. Yes, the only way a government can try to get ahead of this sort of crisis is to have a rhythm in which it can issue sort of command and control instructions and then follow through on them. And really, in the past few weeks, the government was getting into that sort of rhythm with a daily press conference. But that was all blown apart when Boris Johnson got ill. And at the same time, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, had to absent himself because he got ill as well. And there was a definite wobble in how the country felt about how the government was delivering during a period when those daily press conferences quite rightly had to continue, but that neither Boris Johnson nor the Health Secretary were available. And instead, we saw a succession of other cabinet ministers who just didn't seem to understand what was going on and indeed what was required in terms of confidence building amongst the public. Fortunately, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, came back and he was able to really exercise some impressive grip when he did his first press conference when he was back, setting an ambitious target of 100,000 tests by the end of this month. And just a word on that, that really is where the public and the journalists have focused in terms of whether the government is managing this well. It's one of the targets that they're going to be holding the government to, and which they look around other European countries and see that they are way in excess of what the UK has been achieving. So this target of 100,000 for testing is very important for the government to deliver on, and is very important as well for making sure that we have the tools in place for planning some sort of exit. Originally, Boris Johnson said he thought that this lockdown would need to last for 3 weeks, although he was sufficiently vague about that, that most of us thought it could be extended. Now the position is that it's likely to be extended, although we don't know when we'll hear more about that, probably next week. In terms of decision making while while Boris Johnson is in intensive care, we have a very different system in the UK to the American system, for instance, where they have a vice president. In the UK, it is very much the prime minister who is in charge, but he is the first, or she is the first amongst equals. So it is primarily cabinet government. Cabinet is always set up with committees, and committees of cabinet have the authority of cabinet if it is properly minuted. So cabinet government will continue. Dominic Raab has been effectively anointed as Boris Johnson's stand-in. But we mustn't deceive ourselves to think that he has the sort of decision-making and authority that Boris Johnson has. He doesn't. Really, the Prime Minister's authority comes from two main sources which he alone has. One is to propose legislation, and the other is to set his own cabinet, which means that as a cabinet minister, if you are asked to do something and you fail to do it, or even if he doesn't like the way you're trying to do it, he can fire you. It's been clear that Dominic Raab doesn't have either of those authorities, so he will be chairman of the board, really, rather than a single authority on his own. I must quietly observe that with Michael Gove staying at home, he's likely to be less challenged than he might have been as cabinet will sit regularly during this period. Meanwhile, my impression is from the country as a whole that the fact that Boris Johnson is not just ill, but in intensive care, has really stopped everybody in their tracks a bit. There is less complaining about trivial things. There are less hostile questions from the journalists. It just feels a bit inappropriate while our Prime Minister is in intensive care. There is real unity of purpose amongst the government and in the country about caring that our Prime Minister makes a swift decision. So I think that's had a galvanising influence, and I expect for now government will continue in its rhythm with Dominic Raab chairing cabinet meetings and making those decisions. It's not going to be sustainable for very long. Those press conferences, there's going to be daily results to convey to the public, when actually we know that there aren't. And without the Prime Minister conducting those, giving authority, it's going to be tricky for them to be sustained. So like everybody, I'm wishing the Prime Minister a swift and complete recovery, but he cannot stay out of this fray for very long. Thank you.
Amber, that was fascinating. Just to remind people about the chat function at the top right-hand corner of the screen, you can ask some questions on that, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions about what's going on in the UK government as well. I'm going to go now to Adrian Gore. You're the CEO, Adrian, of a major international business. Can you tell us about your experiences of dealing with it, particularly as you're in Johannesburg, but you are also in markets that are all around the world? So, Adrian, just to check, you're off mute.
I think I'm put. Craig, is that, am I coming through? Sorry, that was... So, Craig, thank you for that, and I hope I can add some value. You know, we're an international insurer, predominantly life and health, operating in about 24 countries. You know, our model is different, Craig, as you know, this kind of shared value idea of incentivizing people to manage their health and pricing that into the insurance through Vitality. That has been remarkably kind of applicable in many, many countries. And I think why I mention that is I think that the COVID-19 pandemic for us as a business is particularly complex. And I think for two distinct reasons. One is our model, our business model is about life, mortality, sickness, and predominantly physical activity, trying to keep people physically active. The truth is that this pandemic has kind of attacked all three of those aspects quite substantially. The second is that our base, although we're global, our base is South Africa, and this debate between economy and health in the South African context is particularly complex. As you all know, we have the highest level of HIV/AIDS. We have 7 million people living with HIV/AIDS in the country. We have considerable inequality. We have tens of millions of people living in tight township kind of areas where social distancing is very, very difficult to achieve. And we have just generally immunocompromised people. So the virus presents a considerable health threat. At the same time, the economy is relatively weak. Our government does not have the fiscal headroom that, you know, the UK or the US or other developed countries have. So this kind of developing environment creates a very, very complex, how can I say, tapestry for this for the virus. I would just say, just to make the point, is interesting. Our country imposed a lockdown quite early on in the, I think, 10 days from the first infection. It's a very severe lockdown, so there's no mobility at all outside of the home. You cannot go for a run. You can't go for a walk. You can go to the shops and get essential food, but the entire country is locked down. It's quite remarkable. And I'll tell you that we have about 1,600 infections, which is very, very low. 11 deaths we've kind of ready for. We've ready the hospitals. At the moment, we're doing very, very well, despite having a very weak base. But having said that, I think there's kind of this synthesis between a very complex business model and a developing world home base has made it quite complex. So just to make a few points, Craig, around just our response, we've been fairly disciplined around focusing on our people, our staff, on our customers, and very importantly, on our country and the countries we operate in. You know, we're in 24 countries. We're in China as a health insurer, ironically, with Ping An. So the original kind of the outbreak of the virus was there, and we did experience that. But we focused very carefully across three areas. On our people, this, I wouldn't waste time here, but to say that I think we acted swiftly, and like most companies are fully operational, largely at home. I would say one just interesting insight from a CEO perspective, there's a greater sense of community in our business, ironically, while we're at home than we had when people were in one campus. I think we've done a really good job through technology of webinars and community and just keeping our people really much engaged. And I think that is powerful. On our customers, I wanted to make some points about the need to rework all of our products. We've really, as a health and life insurer, added all kinds of things around the COVID virus itself. In the UK, we're offering a cash benefit for people who have, instead of just a normal PMI, private medical insurance, you get a cash benefit daily if you suffer from a virus. So there are a number of things that we've done to try and modernize the products and make them fit for purpose in this environment. If you know our products like Vitality, they incentivize all kinds of wellness, but physical activity, we've had to reconfigure that. And we've now made it entirely kind of Vitality at home. So focusing on keeping people at home, being physically active at home, using our ambassadors like Jess Ennis and Johnny Wilkinson and others to actually inspire people via video and Instagram. We've refocused our benefits like our healthy food benefit to Waitrose, where you get discounts on healthy food. We've upped those discounts to help people at home. So we're doing a lot of stuff around trying to make the lockdown kind of bearable and affordable. And then importantly, we're using our data, I think, very well. So we've isolated out the people we know are vulnerable. So from the base of literally millions of people, we know those people, the kinds of comorbidities that expose them to the virus, we know demographics. So we're reaching out proactively to those people we think are vulnerable and trying to educate them about lockdown, about isolation, about what they need to do. So there really has been a very focused approach across our millions of clients. And I think that kind of a battlecry, trying to make sure people don't die from this virus, if we can achieve that, is a critical, critical thing for our organization. And then I just would maybe like to end on just the country issue. There's a lot of stuff we're trying to do, certainly in our home base of South Africa, because of the vulnerability of the country. We're doing a lot of work in the command center of government, trying to help out around getting hospitals ready, getting our testing ready, et cetera. But we've done a few things that I did want to mention. One is that we've made our virtual GP online consultations available to our 53 million South Africans entirely free. So we worked with a telco to make data free, to make the consultations free. So trying to use the chassis of the organization to benefit, you know, tens of millions of poor South Africans who actually have no access to healthcare at all except the overburdened public system. And then we are kind of paying forward a $5 billion fund. It's about $500 million to try and keep the private healthcare system, doctors actually earning some kind of income, from almost anticipating the claims they would have made, the billing they would have done, and paying them up front during this lockdown period so they can stay solvent. And when we get through this, they can get back to work and actually, where needed in the front line, they're actually able to afford what they need to do. So, Craig, just to end off, I think just trying to illustrate, I think there's a lot we're doing, but we're focused in a disciplined way on our people, on our 12,000 or so people across the world. We focus very much on our customers, on our 20 million customers, reconfiguring products. And we're doing things, I think, in a country like ours where government needs the private sector to do many of the functions that I think in a developed world government would do. So there's a lot happening here. It'd be interesting to hear the rest of the deliberations. Thank you.
Adrian, that was excellent. And I'm sure lots of people will be putting some questions in the chat function, which is in the top right-hand corner. Please do that. I'm going to throw now to Jerry Hauer, who's got up very early this morning and is in Northern Virginia. Jerry, it feels like a lot of countries are running to stand still on this crisis, not least the United States. Tell us about what's going on in governments to try and get ahead of this in the epidemiological community.
Well, thank you, Craig. Let me give a perspective on where we are right now. We have about 400,000 cases and about 12,000 deaths. New York, which is the epicenter here in the U.S., has about 150,000 cases and over 600 deaths, well over 600 deaths. We really have struggled with a lack of central leadership here in the U.S. Governors and mayors have pretty much been left on their own to support response and control of the outbreak. Governors and mayors have found that they cannot depend on the federal government for the kinds of resources that one would expect and one that has been planned on for many years in the past. Recently, Jared Kushner had a comment that the U.S. Central Strategic Stockpile was owned by the federal government and not the states and cities. For many years, states and cities have depended on the Strategic National Stockpile for the kinds of support that were necessary to respond to an incident like that. Right now, we don't have enough testing to detect people with the virus. That is absolutely critical in trying to control the outbreak. All of this disorganization has led to a difficulty in managing and trying to control the outbreak, and just as important, in trying to manage the overwhelming number of patients and reducing morbidity and mortality. Let me turn to what it would look like to reopen the country here and get things back on track, or get back to what is being called the new normal. Central to reopening the country is having a unified, overarching plan from the federal government to prevent these mini epidemics around the United States from being controlled in different ways. By that I mean, if one city were to reopen and we don't have that kind of uniform policy, people migrating from other areas of the country could bring the virus back into that city. So we really need to be on lockdown across the whole country for a period of time to ensure that the virus is actually under control. Just as important, businesses will need to understand there will be external forces that allow them to, in a very measured fashion, reopen. Those external forces will be the federal government, state and local governments, public health agencies that will manage and control the very measured reopening. Central, again, to reopening, and absolutely critical to allowing us to start to get back to this new normal, we will need to have a significant reduction in the demands on hospitals. We will need to have an enhanced public health surveillance system to ensure that we catch even the smallest uptick in the number of cases so we can get that back under control. We're going to need widespread antibody testing. Now, we need to recognize there are two types of testing. One is to test for the virus itself and to be able to determine who actually is sick, and then it's antibody testing to determine who has the immunity because they've been through the virus, they've been sick, whether they were symptomatic or asymptomatic, they'll develop this immunity. So testing for the antibodies is going to be absolutely critical, and we don't have that test yet. Finally, we'll need therapeutics. We will need antivirals to shorten the severity and the course of the outbreak or the disease when one gets sick. The antivirals will also not just shorten the course, but reduce the intensity of the sickness or illness in a person, thereby reducing demands on hospitals. Finally, we are going to need a vaccine. These first four components are near term. Those will allow us to get to a point where we can begin to reopen and get things back to normal. A vaccine will be critical in ensuring, if this is a seasonal type of virus, that we can control it as it returns next fall or next winter. Finally, the first four components are in place or are being put into place. As I said, the vaccine is somewhat down the road, probably 18 months as an estimate. Businesses are going to have to understand, and society is going to have to understand, that reopening is going to be a very slow, very measured process, so we don't wind up with a second wave of an outbreak. With that in mind, I'll turn it back over to you, Greg.
Jerry, that was great. Thank you very much for that. And we're starting to see lots of questions flowing in. Please keep them coming. We're just going to finish this section by throwing to Wolf now. Wolf, you're monitoring what's going on all around the world. Is there a cause for optimism, do you think, as we see it progress through APAC and EMEA?
I think I will be very cautious about optimism. Maybe we can start from there. Well, Wuhan finally was reopened overnight. That is after 76 days of lockdown. And still, we are talking about a very gradual reopening with an application with technologies used to monitor the movement of people, making sure they are not sick and they are not getting close to anybody sick. That is something that China can do. I'm not sure we can try to replicate that in continental Europe or in the UK. In terms of Europe, there was a press conference this morning by the WHO Europe director. He indicated that now, if we look at the 10 worst countries affected by the crisis so far, 7 are in Europe. So if on one side, Italy and Spain, maybe they are over the peak, there is a surge now in Sweden and in Turkey. So the picture there is still fairly mixed. Interesting enough, what is going on in continental Europe is a growing debate about exit strategy, which is a misnomer, because as already Jerry alluded, is not an exit. It will be an opening. An exit is not going to be achieved until we have a vaccine here. So we have seen that debate catching up. And interesting enough, the debate is already creating lots of divisions in Europe. The Commission was supposed to announce yesterday its roadmap for exit, and suddenly some member states like Italy, Spain, and France didn't like the idea, and the Commission has been forced to freeze this roadmap there. So as much as we saw the divisions and tension among member states of the European Union when it was time to impose restrictions, we are seeing the same story now when the debate is just really in these early days about moving these restrictions. Looking ahead, I think it's the main risk here is what I already alluded last week, this lack of coordination and synchrony among member states in terms of easing, specifically in terms of public health and also in terms of working together on the economic front. So these are the two key areas where I think we need to monitor. The other area, and I think it's connected to what both Amber and Jerry mentioned, is about leadership is important, but also state capacity here is critical. Because at the end of the day, if state capacity was critical when it was time to impose the restrictions, I think it's going to become even more important because the easing, the opening, whatever you want to label it, will be a very prolonged phase. And state capacity will be critical to provide the tools that would allow this easing to happen. So, for example, in countries like France, Spain, and Italy, they're talking about having to use masks. Well, if you're not able to deliver this mask to your citizen, we have an issue. They are talking about using technology to monitor the movement of people, to make sure they don't get sick and so on. Again, you need to have the capacity to put together these systems. So state capacity and the loss of these countries because of the austerity over the last 10, 15 years, this capacity and this capacity also to plan, you know, central planning was always a kind of dirty word for a long time in developing my economies. I think we have to start thinking about central planning. And that is something that Jerry mentioned earlier as well. The focus should be really, in our view, on this ability of government to keep these efforts for a long, for a prolonged period of time. What was interesting earlier this week here in the UK that the chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, mentioned that there was something to learn from the German experience. Well, learning is always a very valuable thing to do, but on the other way around, if you don't have the infrastructure, you don't have the labs, the testing kits, the digital technology and else, and you don't have the ability to deliver, there is only so much that learning can help you. Final point here, just a quick snapshot here of what we have seen from various member states in the European Union when they talk about opening. Well, opening, Austria was mentioned this week with headlines about opening, actually is an extension of the existing restriction in reality. So, for example, there is still a public ban. There is a ban on public events until June. Masks will have to be used. Shops might be able will be able to reopen from the 15th of April, but still with social distancing and a controlled number of customers inside each time. And Austria is able to do that because they are doing daily testing of almost 50,000 people per day in a country of less than 9 million people. In Italy, there is a huge pressure on the government now to start thinking about reopening because of the economic damage suffered so far. What we're talking about, what they're considering in Rome is a gradual reopening in terms of business, in terms of manufacturing, construction, maybe commerce, but still having this social distancing, protecting the health of the workers will be key to get this permission to reopen. At the same time, they will keep going with the mass testing. They are working on an application to track the movement of people and also to testing in terms of checking people who have developed the antibodies against the virus. So it's a fairly mixed picture here, but the bottom line here that we're talking about a very gradual opening, which will entail a very prolonged state effort. And on that front, some countries will certainly do better than others. And let me stop there. We are just half an hour into the call. Back to you, Craig.
Thank you, Wolf. Okay, Amber, we're getting quite a lot of questions about the tension between governments having to provide a running commentary on things. So, for example, when Britain announced that it was going to go into lockdown, it said it would review it after 3 weeks. It now looks like number 10 is like doesn't want that three-week deadline on Monday to really exist. There's also the fact of what is the state of the Prime Minister's health and the consequences of that. Are we seeing a real difficulty about the fact that in the modern era, there is this expectation of a running commentary that perhaps previous crises and things that wasn't there?
Yes, I think that is the case. But I also think a daily press conference would have been the right thing if it had been able to be the Prime Minister on a daily basis reassuring us, which was largely the plan that they put in place originally. And the fact that they have to stick to the daily press conferences, and then we had the Health Secretary ill, and now Michael Gove is ill, so it's a limited number of people who can actually manage these press conferences is definitely a problem. And the fact is that the really interesting statistics that people are looking for are about whether we can, you know, go some sort of beginning of the exit, as was being said just earlier, some sort of opening up of society back again. And those don't flow on a daily basis because they have such a large time lag. And even today, when they were talking about, the medical officer was talking, chief medical officer, about there may be the glimmer of a hope that the curve may be flattening. You know, this is going to take weeks to be certain of. So I just think the daily press conference is inappropriate, really, in the absence of a prime minister and in the fact that this disease has such a long time lag in terms of seeing whether it is indeed coming off.
And the flip side of that, though, is if there's a vacuum, people will start trying to fill it and journalists will want to fill that and create mischief.
Yes, there is that risk. But in a sort of balance of difficulties, I think that this one was right at the start, but is creating its own difficulties because of the absence of the Prime Minister, which, of course, nobody anticipated.
Yes, and they also managed to have a...
Can I just come in on this one, Craig? Because what is interesting in the other country, European countries, you haven't seen the Prime Minister doing this. In Italy, it is run by the guy who runs the Civilian Protection Agency. So in Korea, where this generally regarded as a successful example on a variety of fronts, it was all done by technocrats. So when we compare to lots of other countries, the UK experience here is a bit unique.
Yeah.
Yes, it is interesting the way the UK has taken the political route in terms of handling this, which I imagine was part of the Prime Minister's decision to personally try to reassure the country and give that information out. And so that's compounded the difficulty that we're in now by the fact that instead of having, which you may have in Korea or in Italy, health-orientated journalists asking the questions, you've got political journalists asking the questions, which is sort of a bit of a conflict now. Political journalists asking questions of chief medical officers. Sometimes that feels a bit odd.
Yeah. So, Adrian, we've got a question here from David Ray from BP. He says, do you see an evolution in the use of personal health biometric data from reducing insurance premiums to early warning indicators of future similar events?
Craig, it's a great question. I'm not sure the answer. I do think our data shows that people are managing their health obviously have better immunity, and if we can avoid people having the kind of comorbidities that they have that we've seen in this virus, it would obviously be a good thing. I do think that if we can tailor some of the stuff that we do to helping people strengthen their immune system and those kinds of things, so a slight refocus, I think it will be helpful. But I think we should be careful not to create a sense that this thing is avoidable that easily. I think it is a very difficult thing to deal with without things like a vaccine and antivirals, et cetera, mentioned earlier, I think, by Jerry. But I do think that those kind of things, the more scientific, the more data we have, our ability to help people navigate this in the future will be much more powerful. We are thinking about focusing on trying to measure immune strength and how we can kind of intervene and incentivize those kinds of behaviors that enhance it. So there's a lot of thinking there, but I think it's early until we really understand the data.
And I was struck by the fact that when you were talking about being in South Africa, where there is this extreme difference between often the haves and have-nots, lots of people living in townships very close to each other, the country is also surrounded by other countries where they don't have the healthcare systems you have. How worried are you about Africa as it begins to spread?
Well, I think we're very worried. You know, these numbers can become very big very, very quickly. You know, the one interesting issue, it's at this stage purely a theory, and it really is there's a correlation. There's no clinical mechanism identified, but the BCG vaccine, which is against tuberculosis TB, which has been done in Africa, I think, over the last 50 years on a compulsory basis, there's a correlation between that vaccine and lower rates of infection. So there are these kind of theories that are giving people hope. I have to say that there's no yet data on this to harden those views, but I think we are very worried. At this stage, it's quiet. Hospitals are fairly empty, so it's kind of – it's also summer, so there may be correlations to heat and winter. So we're very, very worried. The country's in lockdown. I don't think the borders are locked down, but we're going to watch it very carefully and get ready for it.
Yeah, I was speaking to somebody in the Department for International Development in the UK yesterday, and they were saying some African countries literally have one ventilator. So obviously it's a real worry. Jerry, David Ray also asked a question for you. How does this emergency event differ from other experiences and events that you've covered? Jerry, I think you need to come off mute.
I think that this one, unlike many of the others, Tony Fauci, the head of the National Institute for Infectious Disease put it perfectly. With a hurricane, tornadoes, terrorist attack, chemical, biological, you have something you see, you understand, you know. A virus, you don't see, you can't control it. You have a difficulty understanding or trying to understand the trajectory. With SARS, the outbreak burned out very quickly, had a higher case fatality rate, but it was here, it was gone. This, we have no idea whether it's going to be seasonal. We have no idea when we reach these plateaus like we're seeing in Europe, whether the plateau is going to be there for a period of time or whether or not it's going to drop off. So the ability to really understand the trajectory and the impact is completely different than other types of disasters.
That's fascinating. We've also had a comment here from Padraig Slattery in Ireland. He's saying that their daily press conference is headed by medical experts and only secondary commentary from the health minister, which that goes to the point about how the President of the United States and Boris Johnson, before he was ill, was dealing with this. Natalie Jane McDonald, I think this is another one for you, Jerry. The pressures of the pandemic and the need to be seen to be responding has led to different governments doing different things in areas such as PPE, mask utilization, for example, or treatment like hydrochloroquine. The pressure is understood, but there is a cost both direct and indirect to this. How do you feel about the voice of the WHO in the crisis and its leadership of evidence-based approaches?
I think the WHO has been very weak and has shown very little leadership. I think they've been invisible. I think at the beginning of the outbreak, they were very slow to get engaged. I think that they were very unwilling to declare it a pandemic. I was calling it a pandemic weeks before the WHO. I think it's unfortunate, but I think they've been a non-entity.
Yeah. There's lots of questions about that this is obviously going to go on for some time. I'm going to start, let's explore that theme a bit. Adrian, I'm interested in you as a business leader. You've got thousands of people working from home, trying to keep the business going. You were telling us about your strategy of having to change how you're incentivizing people, that kind of thing. Can you speak to the fact that you're going to have to lead people through this for many months to come and what you think, how you think that's going to develop?
Craig, I don't know the answer to that. I think people are expecting some kind of clarity about this kind of reopening and when it will happen. I think as long as that is uncertain, there's just a kind of an anxiousness, almost a grieving of, you know, of what might happen. So I think as kind of business leaders, I think we have to be authentic and realistic. And I think just continuous communication to people and trying our best to feed them with proper information. We know the lockdown dates here when they're meant to end. I think people in their gut know that this is likely not to happen, that it's going to be longer as the UK is showing these things take time. But I do think just continuous communication and trying to give people a sense of the kind of variables we need to watch to achieve a reopening rather than this binary will it or won't it. Because as we've heard from these esteemed panelists, it's not going to be an opening, you know, as it was before. Things will gradually hopefully open. So I don't know the answer, Craig. I think it's trying to get people to see things a day at a time and just relax. We have to work our way through it. But I think as leadership, you've got to give people hope. You've got to give people a sense that you know, humanity will work this thing out. We will work our way through it. I think without that, people are left, I think, very, very anxious. So I hope I don't sound patronizing. I think it's very difficult. I'm not sure the answer yet.
That's perfectly understandable. Amber, a lot of private conversations that this realistically people are going to be in their homes until June in the UK. How do you think the government should be breaking that to people? And we're also coming up to a major bank holiday weekend. We've got Good Friday and Easter Monday. Presumably people are going to want, there's pressure to go out and about, that kind of thing. Can you talk to that?
Yes, I mean, there is pressure on that, and there's been some disagreeable and controversial activities by some of our local police forces in the UK that have irritated people about going too far, sending up drones when they were walking in the park and stuff like that. But overall, I still think that it's holding firm, this concept and this campaign to isolate, to stay at home in order to save lives, to protect the NHS. But obviously it's finite. And I think that we're more likely to see the type of so-called exit that has been set out earlier in this conversation than the other, i.e. like Austria, partial, but it won't start for a few weeks. And I hope that people will sort of take it moderately. I mean, the biggest question that is now becoming only just second to the issue of people's health is the enormous amount of businesses that are going to start to go bust. All those small and medium enterprises who thought they could access loans, who are not being able to access them, who are struggling to continue, who some of whom can access the furlough system, others who can't because their people are working flat out but are still not getting orders. I think that every week that goes by during the next few weeks, we're going to see a terrible rise in the collapse of businesses. And that, of course, is going to have a deleterious consequence, not just on the economy, on people's health. So at what point that will cross over, of course, none of us know. But I do think that it will be part of the thinking in government right now so that they can start to reach for at least a partial exit in the next few weeks.
With your hat on as a former Home Secretary, you must be worried about, I'm looking out of an office here and looking out over lots of tower blocks where, you know, people are kicked inside, they don't have outside space. They obviously want to go and be in the park or whatever. How worried are you about that side of things?
Well, I did enjoy the comment that I saw in the paper yesterday that the police were finding it easier to arrest well-known criminals because they tended to find them at their homes. So yeah, policing has certainly changed to a certain extent. And in the UK, one of the biggest areas of crime has always been the so-called nighttime economy, of which there is none. I'm more worried, actually, about the growth in cybercrime, both in terms of businesses, who I'm sure and I hope are taking extra precautions now because there are just more cyber criminals with more time on their hands to try and step it up. And in terms of the really nasty type of crime, like online grooming of children, that is increasing. And it's something that we should all be more worried about in terms of crime than anything else at the moment.
That's interesting. Jerry, in the United States, we're seeing the issue of the federal government not imposing its will across 50 states and just very radical differences between how governors are dealing with it. Given that, you know, other countries are able to impose a unified structure, how worrying is that in the United States?
Well, it's very concerning, particularly when you think about trying to reopen or begin the process of reopening. If we don't have a unified structure and we have this rather haphazard organization, and particularly when we see some of the governors just absolutely out of touch. You and I were talking earlier about the governor of Georgia, who just two or three days ago realized and made the pronouncement that he is closing the state because he just found out that the virus spreads from asymptomatic people, something we've known for the better part of 2 months. With that kind of disorganization and lack of uniformity, it is going to be a lot more difficult to try and reopen things here in the US.
Thank you. We've got a question here, Wolf. I'll throw this one to you from Ashgar Jamil. As governments reopen gradually, how will this impact reopening of offices and ensuring safety of employees while lacking testing and monitoring? How should organizations approach it? Are you seeing differences in the way that that's coming up around the world?
Well, when you look at when you look at reopening, there's going to be a process. The first people to go back into the workforce are going to be those people that we know are positive for antibodies, so they're protected. At the same time, there will be gradual reopening of businesses. Again, the first people going back into the workforce will be those that are protected. There will be a slow integration of other people as businesses start to reopen. The same thing with government. The last people to go back into the workforce are going to be those with comorbidities. We're going to want to keep those at home for as long as possible to ensure that the virus is controlled. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No worries. I totally agree. Obviously, I think it's going to be a very risk-adjusted approach. So, for example, when we look at this, what we've seen so far in terms of Italy, Spain, France, we are talking about specific sectors of the economy, manufacturing, construction, as long as you're still able to protect the workers. Usually this is done by involving trade unions agreement. In the case of Italy, for example, the authority that is supposed to oversee whether these health protections are still in place is a representative of the government, the prefect. And the other thing which is also will be used is relaxing this restriction by age groups and by geographies. Because, for example, in certain countries, certain geography will get out, they will see an easing earlier than others. In the case of Italy, it's very obvious that around the area of Milan, there is a good chance this restriction will remain in place longer than in other places. So I don't think there is a unique formula. One of the challenges, which I think is very similar in Italy and the UK, is the presence of lots of small companies. In Italy, 95% of the businesses, they have less than 10 employees. And in the UK, we don't have a similar number, but still SMEs are a key part of the economy. They most likely they will face more difficulties in terms of being able to reopen while keeping all these safety protocols in place than bigger companies in comparison to bigger companies.
Thank you. Adrian, we've got a question from someone who I think is not a million miles away from you. What are some of the unique challenges facing insurers during this time, and can they adapt quickly enough given insurers are typically slow-moving and heavily regulated institutions? So Adrian, I think you're on mute again.
I've been muted at the center. Craig?
We can hear you.
Okay. So Craig, I think insurers are in a very complex situation. I actually think they will move very quickly. The obvious issue is if the number of deaths reaches some of the more catastrophic projections, which I don't think will happen. I think that the lockdowns and the various interventions will be much more powerful. But obviously just the cost of claims creates a massive, massive strain for the insurance industry and creates a kind of a shifting of money from insurers into society. It's a massive thing. So I think just the cost of claims, I think, is an issue. The other important point is the massive movements of markets around equity values and interest rates particularly creates all kinds of complex actuarial and valuation issues. So despite in addition to all the social issues of dealing with customers, I think the financial issues are very complex. I think the insurance industry is well positioned. I think they do move fairly quickly financially around readying themselves for this kind of thing. There's a very active reinsurance industry that carries risk on the back end. So my sense is there is great complexity, but within, I think, fairly broad ranges of projections around mortality and morbidity, I think the industry will respond. I hope positively. I also hope coming out of this, some of the models like our own that actually intervene and engage people in being healthier rather than just being transactional, I think will become stronger and stronger. I think the message of institutions having a role to play in helping people live better lives and safer lives, I think, is a message that the industry should be taking forward. So I think there will be change, and I'm actually pretty optimistic about the industry's ability to play its role.
Thank you very much. Got a question from Tom Simonson from Teneo. It's for Amber. Do you think that the election of a new Labour leader will have an impact on the UK response?
I think it's a huge relief that Labour are back. back with somebody sensible leading them, back with a shadow cabinet that has sensible people in it, and Keir Starmer's first steps in terms of apologising to the Jewish community and setting out a practical and very supportive of the government proposals as the new leader of the Labour Party is very promising. And I think in terms of the response, I think it's more stability, because he said he wants to support the government through this area, through this difficulty. So, yes, I think it's a good thing, because he has a sound voice, well respected amongst people, and it'll increase the stability as we go through this and get on to the next stage.
Thank you. So we're coming into the last few minutes. Do throw in your questions on the chat function, and we'll try and get through quite a couple of them before we finish up. Jerry and Wolf, with a lot of commentary in the British papers about lack of American leadership, and that you would normally have expected since post-World War II, that whenever there was an international crisis, that America would be in the heart of it. Do you agree with that, Jerry? Do you think that that is a particular problem and issue? And Wolf, who might fill that gap? So let's start with you, Jerry.
No, I think there's no question that the leadership here in the U.S. has resulted in the expansion of the outbreak early on and in the ability to deal with controlling the outbreak. Finally, the ability to deal with treating those that are seriously ill. Our hospitals are overwhelmed, and I think that the central government, the federal government, has done an extremely poor job at trying to support the state and local governments. So I think the leadership at the top, from the president to some of the cabinet secretaries, has been extremely poor.
Wolf?
Absolutely. Lack of leadership. Is there a suitable replacement? No. There is an ongoing charming offensive by the Chinese in these days going on. Can China bail us out economically? No, because they depend as much as we do on export, and there is no demand for Chinese export. They are in trouble, and I don't think they're interested in providing the kind of leadership that we have seen from the U.S. for a very long time. There is no Chinese soft power. It's mainly about providing certain kind of goods and so on. So there isn't that. One area where I will keep an eye on, and this is early days, is about Asia. If there is any region that could come out stronger out of this, is Asia. Look at the example of South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, to a certain extent even Japan. They dealt with this fairly well. In Southeast Asia, where we have weaker states, we have 650 million people living there in countries like, you know, from Indonesia to Thailand and so on. We got 500 people dead so far. So if I would be looking, I wouldn't be looking for leadership. I would be looking for a block of countries potentially coming stronger. So far, again, early days, Asia here seems to be on the forefront. One final point from me here. We have heard about Easter. We have been heard about the pressure from religious holidays in terms of ability to keep these controls in place. In a couple of weeks, Ramadan is starting. Think about countries like Indonesia, Nigeria, India, where usually you celebrate Ramadan by going back to your village, going, meeting your families, and so on, in countries where the ability of the state to implement this control could be limited. Let's keep an eye on that one.
Very interesting point. Let's bring this to a close with one last question, which is from Darren, and I'll go around the panel, but start with you, Adrian. He's asking, with a significant increase in working from home, how will ways of working change go forward? More specifically, cost cutting in financial services has been a big focus. Do you envisage this leading to a reduction in resources spent on the likes of commercial property? So working from home, how do you think it's going to, let's start with you on business, Adrian.
I mean, Craig, I think it's anecdotal, but there's no doubt people are suddenly learning to work from home very, very quickly, and I think there will be dramatic change. So I do think that, you know, hopefully traveling less and being more efficient and more effective and closer to family, those are some of the benefits I think that we will see. I do think the barrier between home and work being blurred is complex for people to manage than anecdotal. And my sense is it's hard to do new things, to meet new people. without getting out there. You know, so I think kind of a BAU approach from home is doable and possible. I think a growing pioneering business needs to be out there physically as well. So I do think it's a good call. I think we're learning how to work from home. I think there will be profound change, but I think it can't all be online. So I think probably a mix of the two. I don't know the answer to commercial property. These are complex issues, but great question.
Yeah. And Amber, working from home, you were talking about it from a crime perspective. You were talking about online grooming and that kind of thing, but there's also lots of indications of mental health issues and domestic violence.
Yes, I mean, that's a huge issue. We've had 10 fatalities since the lockdown started, which are likely to be mainly caused by domestic abuse violence. And there were two in France since then, but there is a definite escalation. The UN said they think it's up by a third, domestic abuse, because people are in this lockdown. But that is a very different to the issue of, is business going to do more business online, and what's the impact on their future in terms of commercial property? I would just observe that each time I do one of these, I get a little better at it. I'm less likely to forget to unmute myself, etc. So I think we're all being forced to go through this tunnel and get better at it. And as a result, when we come out the other side, we will be doing more of this, which we wouldn't necessarily have embraced because we were slightly nervous of it before this period. So it's definitely been an uptick and a constructive and useful thing in that respect. But basically, I agree with Adrian that if you want to sell things, if you want to really establish a relationship to do business, you've got to see people in person, and that will never be substituted for doing things online.
Jerry, working from home from an academic and medical perspective?
Sure. I think that as we start to reopen business, businesses will be encouraged to slowly reintegrate people into the workforce. They will be encouraged to continue to have people work from home and slowly bring them back. It will be one of the ways to ensure that you can monitor the potential for a second wave. So I don't see working from home being part of the first wave that's reintegrated into the workforce.
Okay. Well, listen, I know a lot of you have got to get onto your next meeting starting at 12:30. We can't all applaud, but I just wanted to say thank you for a fantastic panel. Adrian Gore in South Africa, that was great. Amber Rudd, Wolf Pickerley, and of course, Jerry Hauer in the States. Thanks all for doing it. It was a really fascinating discussion, and we'll do something very similar this time next week. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.